comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. It's a delight to be here, and whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I know you could be doing a lot of other things, but you chose to be here, and I appreciate it. Those who are listening by radio notice that the intro didn't play. I did, too. I noticed it, too. I have no idea why. It appears everything should be working right, but we'll get that worked out. We'll get it ironed out here. No big deal. We're here because you have a right to know. We're here because you matter. Tonight is free to watch night, and we do that a couple of times every month so that those of you who have not yet joined our members community can experience at least a little bit of what we have in the members community. We have a lot of great stuff in there. Watching the show each night, that's one of the great things that's in the members community. Now, if you happen to miss a show, you can always watch the latest show. That means if you miss tonight's show, then for the next 24 hours, it's still up there and available. And you can watch it. So that's one of the things that's in the members community. We also have, of course, our archives, the archives of our shows, the MP3, you know, for your iPods. Got that up there. And even if you don't use an iPod and you just want to listen online, you can do that. Hundreds and hundreds of shows in the archives. You get your own blog page. You get your own photo album. You get your own video album. Forums and chat room and lots of stuff, and from time to time special broadcasts. We have one of those coming up. We have a special broadcast coming up this month. It is a seminar that I'll be leading, and it's called Mars, the Fading Fog. Absolutely free for members. If you are a member, you will get to be there and watch it live free. Okay? No extra charge. We just throw that in as a thank you for supporting the show. And if you're not yet a member, well, you can fix that right now. Just go to my website, click where it says join, and you're good to go. Just follow the procedure there and join. It's only $7.50 a month. That comes out to 25 cents a day, less than you paid for your school lunch when you were in the second grade. And you can't beat it. It's a value unbeatable. We also have something that's absolutely free for everybody called the K-Files. The K-Files is our free weekly newsletter. Be sure you subscribe if you haven't subscribed. And, you know, I guess for some reason, our breaks have decided they're just not going to do their thing tonight. I'm watching the screen over here on the radio automation software, and we should have one up and ready to go, and it's not. So tell you what we're going to do. We're going to step away for break and just play some music. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. It's a little weird, isn't it? I mean, the break without bumper music and all of that. I think I found the cause. And would you be interested in... Probably not, but I'm going to tell you anyway the cause. The radio broadcast computer, although it is set to automatically adjust when time changes from daylight savings time to standard time or from standard to daylight savings time, it's supposed to automatically adjust. The TV computer is also set to do that, and it did. The radio broadcast computer did not change. So it was showing us that we were an hour away, and in fact, we were not an hour away. So, at least that's what I think. My guest is Walter Bosley. Walter, what time do you have?
It is about 10 after 7 here in California.
Yeah, well, we're at the right time, and the computer wasn't. That's kind of weird, huh?
I thought they were supposed to correct themselves.
Yeah, well, it didn't, and so, you know. Anyway, we'll see what happens here with the upcoming breaks, because during that break, I reset its time. Folks, you know, if you've been listening to this show for even just a little while, you know about the Alternative Universe Conference. It's an iConference. From start to finish, it is designed entirely to be live streaming. It's totally unique in the UFO genre. In that all of the others, all these other conferences, people say, well, they got live streaming. Yeah, they do. What they do is they have a conference center or a conference room, and the speakers go there, and people buy tickets and go there and pay for hotels there and pay for food there and pay for ground transportation there. And they have a conference, and all the speakers speak to the people who are there. And if you buy one of their online tickets, one of their streaming tickets, you get to sit on the sidelines and watch. And Alternative Universe iConference is exactly opposite of that. The Alternative Universe iConference, from start to finish, is live streaming. We don't rent a room somewhere, and you don't have to buy plane tickets to get there and hotels and meals and ground transportation. We don't do that. And then the speakers are not speaking to the crowd that's in that room, because there is no room. They're speaking directly to you, live. And then you get to ask your questions, and they will answer your questions. It's absolutely fantastic. Well, we just had the first round, the first session of the iConference, and that took place on May the 3rd. May the 3rd? March the 3rd. I'm a little rattled, huh? And so, but it was a great success. And in this week's K-Files, this last week's K-Files, I put a few of the comments that had come in from people who attended. You saw it, they were enthusiastic about it. They were they're looking forward to the next one. Well, I have good news for you, and the good news is the next one is April the 21st, and the tickets went on sale today. It's $10 now, $10 to attend the conference live. $10 to get five powerful presentations from great speakers. $10, and that's it. I defy you to match that at any conference. I don't think you can do it. But Walter is one of the people who, along with me and Greg Bishop and Dr. Joseph Farrell, are organizing this. And, Walter, tell us what's coming up on April the 21st.
Well, Kevin, we got a great lineup. Again, we have five dynamic speakers with some really great info they're going to be presenting that you will not hear them present anywhere else. And we start off with you, Kevin Smith. And we follow you up with William Michael Mott, and then Don Ecker is going to speak, and boy, is he going to be presenting a doozy of a topic. And then we have Adam Gorightly, who, if those not familiar with Adam Gorightly, go get yourself familiar with this stuff, because you will like it. And then, of course, we have Nick Redfern. And I want to say, too, that tickets are selling already. And that includes, we've sold tickets to attendees that are going to attend this next one. Today, we sold tickets to folks in Canada, to folks in Norway. Tickets are selling.
Already?
Yep.
Wow, that's fantastic. Fantastic. Okay, well, that's great. And, you know, I guarantee you, folks, you are going to miss something great if you miss this. Now, you've got till April 20th, because we have to close ticket sales. And I mean, technologically, we have to. We get to a point where we close the ticket sales. Now, when we do that, then the window of opportunity is over. So, you know, you need to get your tickets, and it's $10. And if you know, when you have a ticket, Walter, one of the great things about this, let's say you bought a ticket to some conference somewhere, and you had enough money, you bought a ticket, and you had enough money to fly you and your significant other out to this city, get a hotel, and you got money for meals, but you could only afford one ticket to the conference. I mean, after you added everything up, you could get you and the significant other there and support you and the significant other while you're there, but you only had enough left over to buy one ticket. So you go to the door at the conference and you say, okay, well, here's my ticket, and I just want to bring this person in with me, very special person. Would they let you do it? No.
Nope.
Now, you pay $10 for this ticket, and you sit at home and watch it on your computer live, and you can invite your significant other to be there. And if you're fortunate enough to have friends that you would like to invite over, invite them over. Let them watch the conference.
Right. Many people pipe their computer feed into their big screen TVs.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, it's something that for $10, you're not even going to match this anywhere. You won't even get close anywhere else. So here's how you do it.
I'd like to also add,
yeah,
you hit on something good there. Think how romantic it would be to set up a little table, a little candlelight, some good wine, you know, a little cheese there, and to learn about lunar anomalies and Mars mysteries with your significant other. I mean, what an incredible evening. And it would only cost you $10 and the bottle of wine and the cheese.
Yeah, or, you know, if you're batching it, if you're a bachelor, forget the wine and cheese and go for beer and tacos. But the point,
there you go.
The point is total comfort and no huge expense. And you're going to get some great speakers and some great information. So here's how you do it. This is one way to do it. Go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down and you'll see great big letters about 4 feet tall. It says Alternative Universe Eye Conference. Click that. And it'll open up the page where you can read about the conference. And there's a link down there where you can, if you want to register, you know, go ahead and register and get your tickets. Okay? All right. Now, tonight we're going to be talking about something that, you know, in some circles it's hotly debated, in other circles it's sort of yawned at, but it's really very, very interesting in the UFO community, in our genre. It's a very interesting topic. And, good, Walter, the software has put up the next break, and it's gonna do it when it's time.
Excellent.
Yeah. Okay, well, negative perspiration on that one, folks. Okay, we got that fixed. Okay, folks, back in 1785, a Frenchman named Jean-Pierre Blanchard made aviation history by performing controlled flight in a balloon crossing the English Channel. Up until then, balloon flights just went where the winds took them. But his accomplishment set off a wave of balloon mania in Europe and in the Americas. In the 1890s, a century after Blanchard made his historic flight, there was a wave of airship sightings across America. Witnesses, in some cases, said that the airships could do maneuvers that normal airships could not possibly do. Well, then in 1897, an airship crashed at Aurora. That's in Texas, Aurora, Texas. And according to the Dallas Morning News, it deposited a dead alien pilot. The airship mystery had just entered the UFO zone. Well, some of the airships in this wave of airship sightings in the 1890s were undoubtedly just airships. Some were possibly alien craft, the long cigar-shaped alien craft, because of the reports about maneuvers that they could do that no airship, no normal airship could do. But all of them were mysterious. Now, someone that has done quite a lot of research that has led over, it was not focused on this, but it has led over into this whole phenomena of the airships, is Walter Bosley, who's with us this evening. Walter is an author, a publisher, former federal agent, and I asked Walter if he would be with us tonight to talk about this airship thing, because frankly, Walter, I'll tell you, I've read articles from the time, the reports from the time. I have then read more recent to current articles and recent to current books about this phenomena.
Right.
Or at least they'll reference this phenomena. And a lot of times the more recent stuff references this airship phenomena and makes it into something the reports at the time did not. Now, the reports at the time, there were a number of them that I think we could look at and say, now that's truly anomalous. That's that one possibly could be of extraterrestrial origin. But a lot of these airship sightings, the reports at the time didn't have anything in them that would suggest that it was E.T. And yet a lot of the more current stuff that we're reading basically lays that blanket down on almost all of them. And I want to point something out, and then I want you to sort of lead us off into this. Folks, in 1897, the one at Aurora, now that one's hotly debated too, but let's assume that that one is extraterrestrial, just for the sake of argument. In 1897, people in the United States had been looking up and into the skies, and they had been seeing airships for 100 years. So just looking up and seeing an airship, that's not phenomenal. It might be a little bit exciting. Now I'm going to make myself sound very, very old now. But that's only because I kind of am. I can remember when seeing a jet airplane go across the sky. I was a little bitty kid, but seeing a jet airplane go across the sky was exciting. Wasn't phenomenal, but it was exciting because almost everything was prop driven, prop flown at that time. And I can remember how exciting it was when a jet would go over. Okay, now you can pick yourself up off the floor and stop laughing. And some of you are old enough that you remember it too, don't you? Yeah, because almost everything was, you know, prop planes. Even commercial airlines were prop planes. And when a jet would go over, that was excitement. Well, you see, it wasn't phenomenal because we had seen jets before, but it was kind of exciting. And that's the way it was for these airships in the 1890s. It wasn't that people had not seen them. They'd been flying around the United States and Europe for 100 years. So it wasn't phenomenal. Some of them were. Some of them, as people would look up and see them, they would watch, and these things would do things that an airship can't do. So possibly extraterrestrial, but a whole bunch of them were just airships. But now, having said just airships, let us remember that even though it was just airships, it was in the 1800s. And so it was high tech. For the time, it was high tech. Now, Walter, you've done research relative to your book. Was it The Empire of the Wheel that led you eventually to this information about airships?
Well, like a lot of people interested in UFOs and such things, Kevin, I'd been, of course, familiar. I'd heard of the airship mystery. You know, anybody that had read the books by Jacques Vallée and those, you know, dating back the 70s or the 80s were familiar with this, but I didn't know too much about it. And it was a combination of discovering not only a connection to my Empire of the Wheel mystery in San Bernardino in 1915, but also the fact that my father had a personal connection to a couple of the players in this mystery. And the biggest of which he told me before he died. Of course, my dad was murdered.
Okay, we're going to hold up right there. We're going to hold up right there because we have a break taking over. And we'll pick up right there with your dad being murdered when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Walter Bosley. Now, Walter, you left us right on the edge of our chairs here. You're talking about your dad, and you said your dad was murdered.
Yes.
All right, yes. We've got to pause here for a moment. Tell us about that. What's the deal with that?
Well, in summer of 2007, a once former but then current again employee of his attacked him in his sleep and viciously attacked him. He was in a coma for about 45 days and then came out of that and then died eventually as a result of the beating. And the man, of course, was convicted. He plea bargained, of course, as they do, to a lesser charge than murder. He's firmly in jail now for many, many years to come. And what's interesting is the conversations my dad and I had while he was in the hospital before we lost him. When he elaborated on some experiences he had while in the Air Force, he had started to share with me specifically, he had talked about this since the 1970s, and I've talked about that before, but the specific information relating to the airship folks began in around 1991, 92, when, again, he was in the hospital for a blood clot and was heavily drugged and started chattering a name over and over again and talking about the underground stuff that he had talked briefly about before. And he mentioned a name, the name of Wilson. And I went, of course, by that time I was with the FBI, and I went to my professional mentor at the time, who had been in the intel business for almost 50, by that time 40-something years. And you can hear me, right, Kevin?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. And, you know, I said, you know, I asked him, you know, he's jabbering about this guy named Wilson and something underground, you know, the underground stuff. And, you know, it was suggested to me to get him over the years to talk more about Wilson. Well, indeed he did. And my dad met this particular Wilson individual while on the Air Force project that I have spoken about and has been written about by both Nick Redfern and Mac Tonies, where he encountered the people that, according to him, live underground, and Wilson was in charge of that subject. Now, anybody who is familiar with the airship mystery and things related to it, they know who I'm talking about, the legendary, the mysterious Wilson. Now, I had known, you know, quite a bit about the legend of Wilson and his association to, you know, various things, UFO development, you know, in the 20th century, but I didn't know the great details about the history of the Wilsons with the airship mystery until the early 2000s. And
okay, so hang on just a second.
2007.
Hey, Walter.
My dad and I are having these conversations, and he revealed to me, he told me about encountering Wilson on another project that was based out of George Air Force Base.
Okay, Walter, can you hear me?
50s.
Can you hear me, Walter?
I can hear you, yes. Is there a problem?
Well, I was trying to stop you so I could ask a question.
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's coming across as kind of a glitchy sound.
Okay. Now, a lot of people will not be familiar with the legendary Wilson affiliated with the airships. Fill us in on that before we go forward.
Oh, well, I was gonna lead into that because the revelation my dad told me about the Wilson he encountered leads right directly to the airship mystery. But yeah, I will fill you in. Again, Wilson is a character that in the 90s, when I was first learning about him, he was often spoken of in kind of hush whispers. And when you came across somebody that knew about Wilson and you mentioned Wilson, it was one of those delightful things that you mention in late-night conversations and eyes grow wide and stuff. Wilson it has been a great mystery associated with, again, like I said earlier, the development of anti-gravity and UFO-type craft in the 20th century. Now, I was aware of that Wilson because that Wilson was the one who I was told was associated with my dad in the Air Force project.
Okay.
Now, in the conversation I had with my dad before he died, he's telling me about a project that the anti-gravity Wilson was heading up out of George Air Base, up here off Highway 40, in which my father said in the late 50s he was present when the Wilsons demonstrated anti-gravity platform. Now I asked him, well, who was the other Wilson? You know, he says, oh, his father. We called him the Professor. So I asked him, okay, Professor Wilson and the Wilson. And he said, yeah, Wilson, the one I worked with, was the younger one, but his father, the Professor. Yes, sorry?
I said nothing. We're listening.
Oh, okay. I heard some noises. He named the father. He said, yeah, we called him the Professor, but his name was Hiram Wilson. Well, the minute I heard the name Hiram Wilson, all sorts of bells went off, because Hiram Wilson is one of three Wilsons associated with, directly with the airship mystery, which leads us into the airship mystery of the 1800s, and the Sonora Aero Club, and the mysterious NIMSA. These three Wilsons in the 1800s, Hiram being the younger one at the time, they were from New York, upstate New York, and they, with the other mysterious members of the Sonora Aero Club, had come to California to develop a secret technology that they had discovered and shared and kept secret between them. And this technology enabled them to build these airships, the famous airships of the mystery. Well, Hiram lived, you know, far enough into the 20th century that his son went on to be involved with the U.S. military and the projects my dad was involved with. And my father met Hiram Wilson, known as the Professor.
Okay, now this technology that they discovered and kept secret amongst themselves, this technology was what? Airships?
The technology was what they used for their propulsion and lift. The technology went into the airship motors that allowed them to have the lift, and then, you know, also apply to the motors to move along for controlled flight. And I apologize, Kevin, but I'm getting a lot of feedback, so I don't know if you're hearing that on your end.
No, we're not. Just continue.
Okay. And so that in itself startled me when I found out that my dad had also, you know, worked on something and had encountered Hiram. Now, these platforms, what's interesting about these platforms are that he described them as a big wide square, that they referred to them as the flying squares. They were just big flat platforms, but one corner had a little flangey, a little like finger of metal or whatever, sticking out. And he says that Wilson would tap that little finger sticking out of a corner with a hammer type of device, and then suddenly that would activate the anti-gravity on this platform. And then with kind of a sliding bar control, they could shoot it, get this, according to my dad, they could shoot it up into, float it up into orbit, and then bring it back down. And I asked him, well, what would they use this for? And he said, supplies and personnel. I'm like, to what? And he said, what was flying around up there? And, you know, I thought, well, damn, that's pretty darn interesting. And when you are familiar with the airship mystery, when you get into that little fact about the tapping the little flange on there, mm-hmm. You'll find that was part of the airship technology of the 1800s. When you dig into it, and it matches. Now, my dad, I had never in my life ever heard him talk about the 1897 airship mystery. I never heard him talk about that ever. I wasn't aware that he had ever read anything on it. But remember, what he was telling me about had to do with the Wilsons and a U.S. Air Force project in the late 50s. But this was startling to me because it matched up with what was going on in the 1800s, but of course that led to ultimately to me recognizing some things with the 1915 murder mystery that I write about in Empire of the Wheel.
Okay, now this these anti-gravity platforms in the 1950s were an outgrowth of they came out of the airship mystery.
That is the implication, absolutely.
Okay, and it was used for supplies and personnel.
That's what that was the example my dad gave me.
And when he said it was used for supplies and personnel, and you said supplies and personnel for what? And he said whatever was flying around up there. Did he elaborate on what was flying around up there?
Yes. You know, not in the same term, but spaceships, you know, ships that were in orbit.
In the 1950s?
Of course, in the 1950s. Now, here's what's interesting. In the airship mystery, the deeper you go into it, it leads you into the possibility that in 1908, a journey to Mars was made by Earthmen who were associated with this airship mystery using Tesla technology. Sean Castile has written a little pamphlet-type book on this. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting that you have Tesla talking about receiving signals from Mars, and then you've got in the 1950s, according to my dad, the Wilsons involved with, you know, such things with the U.S. Air Force.
Okay, 1908. Who is it that made a trip to Mars?
It's possible that the NIMZA, this group, the NIMZA, the NYMZA, they are a mysterious group that was the backers of the Sonora Aero Club based in California. Probably it would have been one or more of the Wilsons plus some of the other members of the club that would have made this trip to Mars. According to the...
Okay, I have not read this pamphlet. Now, I have had Sean Castile as a guest on this show,
right,
and certainly have a great admiration for Sean Castile's research and writing, but I have not read this pamphlet, or this pamphlet-sized booklet, about this alleged trip to Mars. Okay, now, here's what I want to do. We have a break coming up.
Okay.
So what I wanted, I wish we had more time before the break, but we don't, and I don't want to get into this and then have to, you know, stop
right
and pick it up again. But when we come back from the break, I've got a lot of questions yet about this airship connection. But when we come back, I want to jump in with this trip to Mars information, because I have not read the book. And I want to get you to sort of bring us all up to date on it and kind of get us up to speed on it, okay?
Okay.
All right. Well, folks, you're not the only one that gets surprised here on this show. I get surprised as well. All right, we're going to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we're talking about this airship mystery, the mystery sightings of airships, a wave of them in the 1890s, and we're speaking with Walter Bosley, and you know, we've already found that there is a follow-on connection from that into anti-gravity research, but as we went away for break, you had mentioned that Sean Castile had written and published a pamphlet-sized book that tells the story of an alleged trip to Mars in 1908. And first of all, I want to make the statement that when we hear that, the very first thing that comes to my mind is, okay, it's one of those comic book stories, and or a Jules Verne novel type story. But what you're saying is that it's alleged to actually have happened, and there's even the name of a group that is alleged to have done this, right?
Yes. Yeah, there's the NIMZA, who remain a mysterious group of benefactors to the Sonora Aero Club. Now, Sonora refers to the little town of Sonora, California, where the Aero Club, A-E-R-O, Aero, was located and where they would operate out of.
Why were they benefactors?
Well, this would have been, you know, as we can imagine, looking back on it, for the time, it would have been absolutely astounding that anybody could do this and the things they could possibly do with it. You know, naturally, you would have men of means who could help make this happen and develop this, wanting to be, you know, involved with this. So, you know, they would get together and do it in a way to, you know, kind of keep it low-key. However, it wasn't as low-key as people are given the impression of today. Back then, it was a little bit more out in the open. It seems to have gone enshrouded as we went into the 20th century, about the time this Mars expedition would have happened.
Okay, you've read the book.
I've read the book, but also I've read a much more extensively researched book on the airship mystery by a researcher author named Michael Busby, who has done for the airship mystery what, in my opinion, Joseph Farrell has done for Roswell, in that he's written the best and most thoroughly researched and analyzed material on the subject. And Busby's research has really, he spells out what actually happened and how.
Okay, so you've read that. You've read the book by Sean Castillo.
Uh-huh.
What's your impression? And as I ask you this, I want people to keep in mind that Walter is formerly U.S. Air Force OSI, Chief of Counterintelligence Operations at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Feet on the ground kind of person. So now, having set that stage, what's your impression of this story, Walter? Did it happen?
I right now, at this point in time, I accept that the basic story did indeed happen. I embraced the idea a long time ago of a covert space program, if you will, effort, that human space travel started well before the 60s. And I've talked about that, you know, here and elsewhere, of course. And there are logical reasons why it would have gone secret.
Well, yeah, I would think so. All right, now, with this story about the 1908 flight to Mars, did they return safely?
My understanding is some of them did, or in some versions they did not, but they communicated with Tesla. That's the theory, based on Tesla's own reported stories of saying he had received signals from Mars. That gets reported to us today as, well, all he was picking up was, you know, was just radio noise, you know, that's natural. When actually you kind of have to, with Tesla, you always got to read between the lines.
Well, you know something, with Tesla, if he said that he picked up radio waves from the sewer lines, you'd have to believe it. You know, if he said he picked up radio waves from Pluto, you would have to believe that. This man was more of a genius than all the geniuses put together in all of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah, he was absolutely amazing, and his hands were in what we're talking about tonight, definitely.
Well, and, you know, we're using electricity tonight, and we're communicating via technology made possible by Nikola Tesla.
Right.
The entire world is using alternating current, and that means the whole world is using Nikola Tesla technology. He invented it. And we could go on and on and on. Every time you've ever gotten a traffic ticket, thank Nikola Tesla for developing radar.
yeah.
You know, we could just go on and on and on. The guy was absolutely phenomenally brilliant. Okay, so if he says he picked up signals from Mars, he did.
Yeah, Yeah, this is where I'm inclined, where Tesla's concerned. But I do want to reiterate that I am not, as we said before, I think I said before, I am personally not an expert on the airship mystery. I have consulted who have demonstrated to me are more expert than I am. But then I took it further, and the reason I took it further was I saw what appeared to be a connection between the Sonora Aero Club and my mystery here in 1915 of these murders I've written about.
All right, now how are these murders hooked in with the Airship Club?
Well, it started, the first clue was with the gentleman who was, and this is reported in the papers, this is in the book Empire of the Wheel, a gentleman by the name of Frank Rosasco, young man, 22, 23 years old, was arrested on a train leaving San Bernardino en route to Barstow. Now, I do want to tell you that Barstow, let's jump forward, and what my dad told me about the flying squares demonstrated by the Wilsons was demonstrated to him at a secret location just northeast of Barstow, in the vicinity of where George Air Base was doing things, okay? So here we go back to 1915, and here's a young man named Frank Rosasco arrested on a train en route to Barstow. Now, the reason he's arrested, this is in November of 1915, the reason he's arrested while all these mysterious deaths and such are going on is that he's hallucinating and kind of wigging out on the train. So they stop the train, the authorities get on there, they arrest him. He's hallucinating, he says, the face of a woman who he claims people are accusing him of committing some act of crime or violence against, that he says he's being persecuted over something done to a woman whose face he keeps hallucinating. And he has in his possession a woman's purse with, I think, $232 in it. And, of course, he had his train ticket to Barstow. So this guy's wigging out on the train. He's taken off the train. And what's interesting is the report does not say he was taken to jail. The report does not give the detail as to what hospital he was taken to, if any. What it does say is that he was released and picked up, put into the custody of, friends from Sonora, California. And then our follow-up research, as Empire of the Wheel shows you, is that he later shows up in all the census records. You know, he's apparently spent the rest of his life up there in the Sonora area. He was from a well-known ranching family up there. And what's interesting is the Sonora Aero Club was known to have ranchers, these wealthy ranch owners, who would allow them to build their airships and store them secretly in their barns or in specially made barns for this. So here we have Rosasco, Frank Rosasco, associated with Sonora in the middle of our mystery. But it goes farther than that with the connections to the Aero Club.
Okay, we have... Pardon me, we have to step away for a break.
Okay.
And we'll pick up there when we come back, folks, with Frank Rosasco. And perhaps my allergies from this awful changeover to spring. I love winter and blizzards. I know many of you are just having a wonderful time because spring is on the way. This awful changeover is killing me. Maybe I'll get over it during this break and we'll pick up right there. Frank Rosasco and Sonora when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and for those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm delighted you're here, and my sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from us during that first hour. My guest is Walter Bosley, And, you know, we talk about the mysterious airship sightings of the 1890s, and some UFO writers today just throw a blanket over it all and say it was all extraterrestrial. I am convinced that some of it was, but there were nefarious mysteries connected with the a lot of the airship sightings. Now, here's the point, and we'll get back to Walter in just a moment, but here's the point. You know, we get this same sort of stuff today. There are real UFO sightings. There's real UFO phenomena. And then there's a whole lot of high-tech experimental aircraft. And it is actually, has been since the days of Truman and then Eisenhower, a plan of the U.S. government to use the real UFO phenomena as a cover, and they just throw that blanket over it all and then deny there's any such thing as UFOs and keep the whole mystery going. That's been going on a long time. And so what we're hearing about is, from Walter Bosley, is a connection in this whole airship thing, in the airship mysteries, a connection to high technology, a connection to secret stuff, and a mysterious group. I think, Walter, you called him NIMZA,
N-Y-M-Z-A, who, by the way, Sechery fictionalized them in his amazing novel, Metamorphosis. The NIMZA make an appearance in there. But the NIMZA was a very real group, according to the airship mystery.
Okay. Now, we have a connection. You have a connection to one of the people affiliated with the mysteries of this time and the high-tech stuff that was going on, high-tech for that time, actually pretty high-tech for now. And that would be the development of anti-gravity. And your connection is that your dad knew Wilson.
Yes.
And he met Wilson's father, also known as Wilson, Hiram Wilson. And Hiram Wilson was one of three brothers who were developing this anti-gravity technology out west and out, I guess, in California.
Yes, Sonora, California, and of course they were flying these airships throughout the Midwest. The Wilsons for a time were doing a lot of operations in Kansas, which is where also my dad had said they were doing a lot of development of these flying squares.
And your dad actually had witnessed a test of these anti-gravity platforms.
Yes.
Conducted by Wilson, not Hiram Wilson, but the
Wilson
son.
Wilson and his father, and Hiram Wilson.
And his father.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're back. I mean, you came at this whole airship thing from two directions. One, your dad gives you information about it.
Right.
And then the other, you're doing research. Basically, you're doing an investigation of a cold case from 1915, I believe it was.
Yes.
And what do you run into? You run into the Sonora Aero Club.
Well, I run into a mysterious encounter, strange episode of a young man on a train who's from the area of the Sonora Aero Club, and you know, is instead of being committed to a local hospital for psychiatric evaluation, he's handed over to these anonymous, unnamed friends from Sonora, and the plot kind of thickens from there.
All right. The young lady that was killed, Cora Stanton,
yes.
And we've discussed this on the air before, And, of course, I've read your book. But Cora Stanton, is there any connection between her and Sonora?
I believe so. Let me say this. I'm beginning to suspect so very seriously, yes. I've not found a direct connection, if that's what you're asking, but with the, I'm beginning to strongly suspect a connection to players or a player involved with the Sonora Aero Club.
You know, it's just possible that she was killed as a result of knowing something that they didn't want her to know about this technology.
And that's very much part of the suspicion when you consider all the other factors that were going on with the espionage activities, the intelligence agents that were around, and all the things that Empire of the Wheel goes into in detail. It looks like the mysterious Miss Stanton might have been a little bit more involved with the Aero Club boys.
Maybe a secretary. Maybe a girlfriend. And just heard too much.
Maybe an intelligence agent who was collecting on them for the opposition or another country. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now the airships that the Wilsons would have been somehow connected with,
right?
Would these have been airships capable of doing things that normal airships could not do? Could they maneuver in ways that normal airships could not maneuver?
Well, when you say normal airships, I'm assuming you mean balloons and zeppelins, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
In as far as probably speed and altitude, yes, the airships of the big reporting, of most of the reports that you hear, and clearly if they took one of these things out into space, yeah, the answer to that would be yes, but I don't want to forget to go back to the further connection, though, between these guys and the San Bernardino mystery.
Okay.
But yes, these airships were more capable than your zeppelins and balloons.
Okay, so what's the further connection here?
Okay, you have, if for those who have read the continuing data that's been collected that I've reported on at empireofthewheel.blogspot.com, there's an individual named F. Lewis Clark, who was a very wealthy man who came from the East Coast for a while. He was in Massachusetts. He was a sailor. He was involved with various major yachting clubs in the U.S. at the time, and he had competed for the America Cup in the past. This man was a very experienced sailor, but he was also, you know, a businessman. He was into lumber and mining up in Washington State, had built a railroad called the Inland Empire Railway in 1906, and then he, for whatever reason, you know, found he ends up in California, specifically in Santa Barbara. Now, in early 1915, is when this man, F. Lewis Clark, this very wealthy businessman, allegedly commits suicide. There's a familiar theme to those who've read Empire of the Wheel. And he allegedly commits suicide by drowning in the sea off of Santa Barbara. Now, they assumed this because all they found was his hat floating in the water. They never found his body. Now, what's interesting is I also discovered that the Southern California area of San Bernardino and Riverside and the surrounding areas was not known by the term Inland Empire until midway late 1914. So here you had F. Lewis Clark, a man who had built something called the Inland Empire Railway 8 years before. Now he's in Southern California, and here you have a newspaper reporter referring to this area here, San Bernardino Riverside, as the Inland Empire. There's a clue that maybe F. Lewis Clark had associates out here in San Bernardino and its sister city over here, Riverside. That's clue number one. Now, here's what's interesting. We have a man, one of our victims in Empire of the Wheel, if you read that book, named O.H. Bailey. Now, O.H. Bailey was a man who they put somewhere around 50 years old, very close in age to F. Lewis Clark, And he would come and go in town. He would be in town for a few weeks, and then he'd go away for a few weeks. And he claimed that he, you know, would work in citrus groves. But he was known to a few people in town. Well, when he is found dead, his body is unrecognizable. The only way that they could recognize, or that they could identify him as O.H. Bailey was in the suit he was wearing. He had some ID on him and some jewelry. And they said, oh, well, this must be O.H. Bailey, even though his remains are unidentifiable. Now, that was in the summer of fall of 1915 that his body was found. It would have been August that this O.H. Bailey man allegedly died. Well, as the Blogspot says, we go into greater detail as to why I suspect that R. O.H. Bailey was F. Lewis Clark, this man from Santa Barbara. In other words, F. Lewis Clark faked his suicide in Santa Barbara, and then he was probably coming here to this area under the name O.H. Bailey for whatever reason, and then faked his death as O.H. Bailey to do God knows what for whatever reason. Now, here's where it gets, again, connected to the Sonora Aero Club, possibly, and the airship mystery. O.H. Bailey was allegedly, he was known to be from Maine, the state of Maine. Now, if you go to the airship mystery, you will find in the reports a man named George Collins, who back in the late 1800s claimed to the newspapers that he was the lawyer who represented the Sonora Aero Club, whose members wished to remain anonymous. But in that interview that he gave to the media, he said that one of their major benefactors was from the state of Maine. So, you have F. Lewis Clark, whose body was never found, in Santa Barbara, which those who have read Empire of the Wheel know the connection with Santa Barbara and the Chumash. You've got this man, F. Lewis Clark, who disappears, who very possibly is the one responsible for this area being called the Inland Empire here in Southern California. And then within a few months, you have our O.H. Bailey, the man from Maine, disappearing. I suspect, and I'm following up on this, that O.H. Bailey was the very wealthy F. Lewis Clark. F. Lewis Clark came to California because he was possibly one of the benefactors of the Sonora Aero Club. Now, if you recall, in the Empire of the Wheel book, Cora Stanton was the mystery woman who appeared to have come to town to meet somebody, particularly specifically a man, and she missed her meeting for whatever reason, and then she ends up dead under very questionable circumstances. I suspect that Cora was associated somehow with F. Lewis Clark, and they were both associated in that way to the Sonora Aero Club, and she might have been, as we said earlier, collecting on them and thus marked for death.
All right. Now, when you say collecting, what for our audience, that means, of course, gathering intelligence. All right. For whom would she be collecting? For whom would she be gathering intelligence?
Well, here's what's interesting. When you go back to the 1860s, a man named Solomon Alexander, who Michael Busby talks about in the best detail you'll find anywhere, who might have been associated with the Sonora Club, he took an airship design to Abraham Lincoln's War Department and demonstrated a flying model for them. But this was in 1865, after the war, right after the war had ended, and War Secretary Edwin Stanton, there's an interesting connection with the name there, Edwin Stanton, Cora Stanton, he told them, nah, we're not interested, the war's over anyway. So after that, the airship guys didn't really seem to be too interested in going to the government, U.S. government, to get them to buy their technology or develop it, you know, for their uses. So it might be that Cora was an agent for the U.S. government to, you know, kind of see, okay, what are these guys up to now? Because maybe they heard the rumors about the Mars mission as well. Or she might have been an agent for the Brits or the Germans, also collecting on the Aero Club, because remember, this was World War One. Now, the Aero Club had a history of being very vindictive to anyone who they thought was going to reveal their secret. There's a history there, if you read the Busby book, they were very vindictive, so it's not beyond the pale to suspect that Cora might have been marked for death by them.
All right. First of all, if there was a plan in the wind, at least the wind around the Sonora Aero Club, if there was a plan to go to Mars,
right?
And I mean, I have to tell you, as open-minded as I am, that sounds pretty fantastic to me. But anything's possible. Do what?
It's absolutely fantastic, and it's almost unbelievable.
Yeah. But let's, for the sake of argument, we'll say that there was this plan being formulated.
Right.
They've already demonstrated their airship to the government. The government has said, "Nah, we're not interested." Right. However, the government, I don't suspect, was a great deal different in terms of secrecy and wanting to know stuff back then, and maybe a little less sophisticated than they are now, but they would have been interested in what's this group up to. So we'll say they get air in their nostrils as well. They get wind of the plan to go to Mars. And they think, oh, that's crazy, it can't be done, blah, blah, blah. But we better have somebody just sort of keep their finger on the pulse of Sonora Aero Club. And so they send Cora Stanton in to do that. That scenario, that's a lot of ifs. But
well,
under
it's
that scenario...
A lot of ifs, but here's some more interesting facts, though.
Okay.
That we have. Remember, in her alleged suicide note, which my co-author, Rick Spence, and I don't believe was, because we don't believe she committed suicide. We believe she was murdered. She claims to have come from El Paso, Texas. Now, Texas is a major area in which the Aero Club airships were seen, and people had interaction with the very human crews and pilots on them. Now, the mysterious man who came in to San Bernardino the day Cora Stanton's suicide note was found, he claimed to know her and that she was from Iowa. Now, Iowa is firmly associated with the Aero Club airship mystery.
Well, there's a lot, that's a lot of very interesting circumstantial evidence, and it makes for some great conversation and speculation. But there's nothing yet that really nails this down to the Sonora Aero Club, does it?
Well, you can look at circumstantial evidence in two ways. You can look at it the way most of the public who, now watch way too much CSI and believe it's reality, to them, you cannot convict and you rightfully cannot convict on circumstantial evidence. But to guys like us, we know damn well that circumstantial evidence means something and it is of value. So people have to retrain themselves. They got to clear out their head the crap that they've learn on TV about circumstantial evidence. However, because it is circumstantial, that's exactly why I continue to dig and investigate this thread. What's there is most definitely, in my opinion as an investigator, what's there is more than enough to continue on this thread, this lead of investigation.
I find it to be very, very intriguing, and I think, there's enough there that I would have to say I have reasonable suspicion. But I don't think I've got enough to go far enough to say I've got probable cause yet. Do you suspect that you're going to get to the probable cause stage with this?
I suspect that the leads I have, and of course I'm not revealing everything here, but the leads I have, I suspect that the odds are good that I'm going to find something that does indeed connect, prove out my suspicion about the Aero Club having their hand in this 1915 mystery. And it may not be a villainous hand. It just might be one of the players in this strange tableau.
Does the Sonora Aero Club still exist?
Not as such.
What has it morphed into?
Who knows? I would honestly say that here's my view on it. Because of what my dad told me and the Wilsons very much being involved with U.S. Air Force, U.S. government space program things and other related programs, I would say that the big turning point was this legendary trip to Mars. I think that that probably finally got the government's attention when you combine that with then the world wars. I think they probably are the ones who made whatever secret space program there is happen, and certainly were involved in making the known programs happen.
Okay. So if this happened in 1908, are we on Mars now?
I like to answer that yes. I think we've been on Mars. To me, you know, when you dig into this deeply and you really look closely like I have at this stuff, it's not crazy to think that somebody got to Mars. Yeah, we're talking over 100 years ago, of course. Yeah, I'm going to say it. But, you know, can I prove it to you? Can I pull up photos and dossiers? Now, it's interesting that there are, as you well know and your listeners know, that there seems to be a lot of interesting things popping up in photos on Mars.
And that's a good place for me to say, and folks, I will be leading a seminar called Mars, the Fading Fog. It's a free seminar for our members. Make sure you join. And you'll get to see some of those pictures. I have a picture in my book on Mars, Walter, that looks like a mosque.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it was taken... You remember the Pathfinder, the very first tiny little rover we sent up there?
Yeah.
It was taken by Pathfinder. And it looks like a mosque.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. If it's not a mosque, then the next thing you could say it looks like is an observatory.
I'd say that's more probably what it is.
Well, an observatory generally has a high dome, and this is a low dome.
Okay.
So it's a different kind of observatory, if that's what it is. Otherwise, it looks just like a mosque. And it's pretty
that's
clear.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty clear. As a matter of fact, it's really clear. And I don't think they noticed it. You know, it was way out on the horizon. But when you zoom in, unpixelated, there it sits. Right, we have to step away for a break. When we come back, we will open up the telephone lines and invite you to join us.
Peak, Virginia, and you are smart because you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Walter Bosley. The telephone lines are now open. 623-444-5889 is the telephone number. 623-444-5889. If you are not in the USA and you're not in Canada, then you can use that number. It will work. However, we understand it can be expensive for the long distance, the international long distance. And so for you, we have something called the flash message. If you are in the USA, if you are in Canada, your flash message, if you send it, will not get through to me. If it does get through accidentally, all I get is a notice that says that it was from the USA and was deleted. I don't even see it. And so use the telephone. That's what it's for. It's a talk show, not a type show, okay? And here's somebody ready to talk. Walter, are you ready to take some calls?
Yes, I am.
All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin, Walter. This is Mike from Kentucky.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Mike. How y'all doing?
Good.
It's amazing. I mean, not amazing, but it's interesting that y'all would be talking on this subject. Because I just happened to have known back in the 1980s, late 80s, a gentleman in Denver, Colorado, who at the age of nine in 1909 saw one of these airships.
Oh, wonderful.
Yep, and he said that he knew the difference between a dirigible and one of these things. And
right.
These things would flat move. He said they were very fast, whereas
yeah.
the dirigible was a little slower.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about, you know, I have a, I guess you might say, a video record of his conversation. And
oh, my goodness.
I thought it was quite amazing that y'all would be talking about that tonight.
How possible would it be to see a copy of that?
It would just be a matter of me making it and giving it to you would be all.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't Kevin, why don't we find some way for him to communicate with us off air so that we can maybe make that happen? I'd love to see that. And is it something you recorded talking with this man?
No, it was done by one of his associates who live out there in Denver. And so he sat and they did a question and answer session. And this wasn't the only thing that that he discussed during this time.
Okay.
I won't go into the other things because right now it's not quite relevant to this particular conversation. I don't.
Okay, I have no problem, Mike, if I know your email address, because I get email from you. I get your newsletters and stuff.
Right.
So it's up to you. If I have your permission, I'll pass your email along to Walter, and he can get in touch with you.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Well, there you go. That's cool.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to, you know, to say.
Well, you know, this is important for people to realize, and that is that the secrecy, keeping it away from the public, that's not new. It's been going on for a long time, and it's possible. I mean, it is possible. It's hard to buy, but it is possible that the 1908 trip to Mars was a reality. And, you know, if that happened, then we were already on Mars and probably the moon by the time Kennedy said, we're going to the moon. All right, to the telephone caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, this is John a little earlier in the evening from Mesa.
Hello, John.
How you doing?
Good.
Well, I was thinking, you know, back in 1908, to have gone to the moon, if we could generate the speed that these things were supposed to go, we could still fly to the moon, feet of the pants, line of sight. And if it was as fast as they say, then there would be minimal storage as far as oxygen, food, depending on how long they wanted to stay on the moon. They could run up there, check it out, you know, see how much, what it was really like, and then come back and make plans for maybe a longer stay.
Yeah, but we're talking about going to Mars. They didn't go to the moon, they went to Mars.
You can still see that, and still line of sight. You know, if you're flying, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 times the speed of what the shuttle goes.
You bring up a good point because it's John, right?
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, John, you bring up a good point because, remember, these are guys who already knew something that, very few others, or apparently no one else knew, about anti-gravity and their propulsion. So what else did they know that other people at the time did not know that would have made it possible for them to travel into space? And let's remember something, we're told things about space, but I remind people, until you go there, you have to rely on what you're told. And, since we're talking about something that would have been very secret, obviously, apparently was, maybe what the nature of what's there has also been kept from us.
Oh, you mean what's on Mars?
Well, I mean, like the atmosphere and maybe, these guys had locked into, some system of navigation that in 1908 they knew how to get there, in a way that would satisfy our 21st century naysayers.
Well, the faster that you can travel, the less you need, very, very large calculations and a computer to track you or to help you. Because, like I say, things don't move that far out of your line of sight. And if you're moving that fast, you can actually chase after it once you got closer.
The problems though that we have with something like this is that we what we know about high altitudes and as you try to leave the orbit of the Earth and there's some very hard scientific facts that don't make that a cakewalk.
If you're overcoming gravity, if you're using anti-gravity in some way. Leaving orbit of the Earth is nothing. The reason a spaceship gets into orbit is because of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're nullifying gravity, then that's not a problem. As for perhaps what we've been told about the atmosphere and so forth might not be accurate, I can tell you absolutely. I can prove it's not accurate. NASA's own evidence proves they've been lying to us about the atmosphere on Mars. Their own evidence.
Right. And if you can repel gravity, then you can turn those machines around and lock out wherever you want to go, and you don't have to track it anymore because you're getting whatever pull you need from that orb.
Well, and also let's remember that we're assuming that these guys did a traditional. This is referred to as a flight. Maybe it wasn't flight as we think of it. Maybe these guys had tapped into some sort of interdimensional wormhole type of a thing that that allowed them to project themselves to Mars, kind of like John Carter in the movie that just came out from Edgar Rice Burroughs' book. There's Edgar Rice Burroughs in 1911 writing about a man who transports himself to Mars from a cave on Earth. That's interesting that was written 3 years after this alleged trip to Mars.
Yeah, it is.
Many of our science fiction authors seem to have ends in the secretive parts of the government and the secret happenings of the world.
Well, one of them, the man who's considered the father of science fiction, Jules Verne, is also associated, interestingly enough, possibly with the Sonora Aero Club in this way. The other best book written about this material is by Theo Pymans. It's about John Worrell Keeley, free energy pioneer, and in that book he talks about Jules Verne being involved with something called the Angelic Society that may have been a group that knew about all this technology, and that's why he wrote about these things. And they might have been associated with the NIMSA and been the group that made this happen. So again, there's many, many levels and much evidence for what we're talking about here tonight. And I recommend people read the Michael Busby book and the Theo Pymans book.
Well, this was also the era. This was also the era when they were building things like the Titanic, huge ships. So, you know, there was a certain amount of technology, maybe not as refined as now, but we don't know what they had. But they certainly had the capabilities of building something airtight.
And what's interesting is a man who died on the Titanic, John Jacob Astor, wrote a science fiction novel himself, and Theo Pymans identifies him as a possible benefactor of the Aero Club and the trip to Mars.
Wow. It just keeps getting deeper and deeper here. I'm gonna have to go get my boots.
Well,
that's all I've got.
What? So.
Okay,
when you
but
read the material, when you jump into this, Kevin, you begin to realize, oh my gosh.
I didn't mean that in the sense that it's normally used. I just mean it's getting deep. It's
but there are people out there who are shaking their head and laughing, but
yeah.
So am
well,
I.
Listen, John, thanks for the call, man. I have to take this next call, but we appreciate it. And it's, ladies and gentlemen, 623-444-5889. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Gave up. Okay. All right.
Sorry about that.
No, when I say it's getting deep, I may have to go get my boots. That normally refers to this is a lot of BS. That's not what I'm referring to. What I'm referring to is it's a rabbit hole. Just when you think you've kind of got it nailed down, you see the lay of the land, you're tossing in some additional evidence that just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So, wow.
You know, here's what I found interesting, Kevin. History was going in a very interesting direction, and then conveniently, there were two little events called World War One and World War Two, which, rightfully so, captured pretty much all the attention. And it's interesting how the things, interesting little things like what we're talking about that were happening up until World War One started, then became kind of pushed aside, forgotten about, so to speak. And you got to wonder how much of that was by design.
So the wars could have been used as a cover.
No, the wars were real.
I know they were, but
clearly, when you have such major events going on, you know, people are going to kind of forget these little stories of men, you know, Earthmen going to Mars in 1908.
I know the wars were real. But they could have been used as a cover, just as UFOs are real and are used as a cover. All right, we're going to step away for break, and when we come back from this break, we will continue with your calls at 623-444-5889. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach. I am still fighting this early springtime. Oh, what a depressing time of the year. Where are the blizzards? Walter Bosley is my guest. I know I'm strange, Walter, but I love wintertime. I detest bright sunshine and warm days and... you know, it was tough on me when I was stationed on the island on East Timor because it's summer all year.
Oh, I love it. I'm a true Southwesterner,
yeah.
Californian.
Well, somebody's got to do it.
That's right.
All right, 623-444-5889. If you wish to talk with our guest, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 623-444-5889. If you are not in the USA and you're not in Canada, you can use the flash message option or you can call us. To use flash message, go to my website, scroll down. You will see the picture about tonight's show, and right above the picture, you'll see the link that says flash message. And if you have a question or comment, you can send it to us that way. If you are outside of the USA and outside of Canada. All right, so I asked you earlier, you've read the books about this. I've heard about it, but I haven't read the books. You know, I've just heard in passing that there was a rumor about this 1908. And as a matter of fact, somebody else brought it up on this show before. And we just, in passing, talked about it. But I asked you before, and I'm going to ask you again, but in a different way, in a little more detailed way. Given everything you know, and given your experience as an investigator, do you find the story to be credible?
Given everything I know, and I'm going to include things that I have not and will never discuss publicly, yes. And that is why I find the leads so compelling.
Okay.
And I know that when people point to known history, they're going to say, but wait a minute, in spite of all that, yes. Remember, I'm not saying they went to Mars with technology on our the way we would imagine it would be necessary. I'm going to say they went there with enough to do the trip and survive.
Well, we could say the same thing about the Apollo flights to the moon. Now, I know a lot of people think we didn't go, but if we did, the technology that we went to the moon in was basically flying beer cans.
Yeah.
You have more computer power. If you're wearing a digital wristwatch, you have more computer power in that wristwatch than the Apollo had.
Absolutely, and too many people don't realize that they went to the moon on less computer technology than that wristwatch.
Yeah, you know, you got to remember when they went to the moon. What was it? The fastest computer was what, a 286?
I think so, yeah.
In fact, are you aware of the fact, as a matter of fact, the shuttle fleet was outfitted with 286s?
Yeah.
In the beginning, and because I remember when they upgraded them.
Yeah,
I remember that it made the news.
The most complicated machine ever built by man.
Yeah.
The shuttle.
Yeah. And they were outfitted with 286s. So, you know, it is possible to do amazing things with scant technology. It really is. But you know something? If you have figured out anti-gravity, you don't have scant technology.
Well, and if you figured out anti-gravity, what else has come with it that might be something people aren't thinking of? And, you know, they're thinking, they're basing their judgment on what we're talking about tonight on what they know. But these guys clearly knew something people didn't know, most people. Edward Leedskalman knew it. Victor Schauberger knew it. John Worrell Keeley and Nikola Tesla knew it. But, you know, these guys knew it. So what else did they know, and what were the byproducts of it that allowed them to do the life support systems and the navigation and such? You know, that's what you have to consider. We are talking about a very secretive group who possessed technology they didn't share with people.
I also asked you earlier if you think that we have bases on Mars. And you did answer, but I'm going to ask you to elaborate a little bit. Do you, to what degree of certainty do you have that we have bases on Mars?
I want to say that I'm more certain in thinking, me personally, that we have them on the moon. To me, that one is a no-brainer. But again, based on what I know, both what I've talked about, what I've written about, and what I'll never talk about publicly, yes, there is a human presence on Mars. And, you know, call it a base, call it a camp, you know. But,
do you know what you get if you burn dirt on Mars?
What?
Oxygen. NASA's own evidence. In 1976 with the Viking lander, and then in 1999 with the Phoenix lander at the North Pole of Mars, near the North Pole. In both of those, they scooped up dirt and burned it. And what they got was a huge release of oxygen.
Well, you know, I do want to throw in that the knowledge I have has to do with it's life under the surface of the planet. So people say, come on, we can see the surface, there's nothing there, so forth. So my information is that the life is under the surface. The habitations are underground.
And they may be. I would not have any problem with that. But I'll tell you this. There's a whole hell of a lot of buildings out there on the surface. And when people say, we've seen the surface, no, you haven't. You've seen what NASA gave you and told you was the
right
surface. And listen, there's a whole lot of stuff they have fixed so that you don't see it. And there are programs that can remove that. And when you remove it, you see cities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, Walter, we're just about out of time here. I want to thank you for being with us. It's been fascinating. You always drop some kind of bombshell, and certainly you did tonight, and I appreciate that. Before we jump off of here, tell us the speakers, and you have to do it quick, but the speakers that are going to be at Alternative Universe.
Alternative Universe are going to be yourself, William Michael Mott, Don Ecker, Adam Gorightly, and Nick Redfern. And for those who want to read the books, Empire of the Wheel at Amazon.com.
All right, there you go, folks. Stay on the line with me, Walter, as I bring this in for a landing. Alternative Universe iConference. The next one is coming up, April 21st. Tickets are on sale right now. It is $10. Okay? So $10 will get you access to the stream, and you can watch the entire conference being presented entirely to you. It's not being presented in a big hall somewhere, and you just get to watch. It's being the whole thing designed entirely to speak directly to you. And there's a question and answer period after each of the speakers. And you'll get to ask your questions and get those questions answered by the speaker. So I can't think of a better way to spend $10. And think of it, 5 speakers, $10. All right, that's going to do it for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.